Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her mouth.
Hot dogs, apple pie, tacos, chili, barbecue, macaroni and cheese, and of course, turkey, and dressing with cranberry sauce and sweet potatoes and green bean casserole. American food. As we gather with family and friends for altogether too much traditional food, we're going to spend an hour today talking about food around the world. From KRFP, Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and today the theme is international food. I have three installments. First, a story by author Peter Chilson, in which a Muslim man from Burkina Faso, living in America, secures a traditional meal for his family. And then we go to the global food crisis. Did you know that 75% of the recent rise in food prices, according to the World Bank, is due to the diversion of food to use as biofuels? What happens in the U.S. affects the world. Or as Dr. Vandana Shiva says, when the U.S. sneezes, the world gets a flu, whether it be a flu of hunger, of economic woes, or of democracy. Dr. Shiva is an Indian scholar and environmentalist, and she's going to talk about the global food crisis. And our last installment is from a Dutch native living in America, celebrating Thanksgiving in Boise.
Whenever I explore the land of Yin, I always take one on the chin. And now this lioness has almost made me tame. I can't pronounce her name, but eggplant is her game. The lady sticks to me like white on rice. She never cooks the same way twice. Maybe it's the mushrooms, maybe the tomatoes. I can't reveal her name, but eggplant is her game.
Installment number one is a story in Peter Chilson's book, Disturbance Loving Species. Peter read this story for a live audience in April 2008 at the Silos Cafe in Moscow, Idaho. The story is called American Food.
It's based on a story an African friend of mine, a biologist at Washington State University from Burkina Faso, told me about just a little kernel of a story that launched my imagination. But he told me a story about wanting to prepare an African meal for his wife and children to give them a sense of the home that they were far away from. It was a meal of goat head. The meal didn't, things didn't go as planned. And, oh my goodness. So I'm just going to read this scene. I'm going to have to break it up slightly so it's at least semi-coherent. But here again is a meeting I hope that evokes a sense of a meeting of Africa and America on the ground of the American West. Keita had good reason to be boiling goat head in the bushes behind his apartment building. He'd planned to cook a meal as a surprise for Isa, his wife, a taste of home no matter what his children thought. His children were very skeptical. They'd lost a sense of their homeland. It made him smile that Ahmed and Fanta, his children, would be horrified at the thought of eating a goat head. His idea was to prepare the head the way his mother had done it, on a bed of couscous soaked in the head's juices, dressed with onions, garlic, and tomatoes, with plenty of salt. So Keita Traore is his name. He has to go out to a ranch, or a local farm ranch, actually, and buy the goat, which means he has to deal with an American rancher in order for this to happen. And here's what happened. Early that morning, he'd been standing outside a large barn negotiating with the rancher from whom he would buy the goat. The rancher, in fact, was a friend, Cheryl Banks. She was a tall, sandy-haired, sunburned woman who taught veterinary science at the college and had an office one floor up from Keita's. Cheryl and her husband ran a clinic on a ranch where they raised sheep and goats and a few horses. In the hallway outside her office a few days earlier, Cheryl and Keita made a deal to meet at the ranch early on Saturday morning. She greeted him at the barn in jeans and a t-shirt, steel-toed work boots, and a dirty khaki baseball cap pulled down over long, thick hair streaked with gray and tied back in a ponytail. Keita showed up in his neat office clothes, wearing sneakers and carrying a leather shoulder bag. She took him into a small enclosure with wire mesh fencing and wooden feed troughs. They fed their goats here in the shadow of a large barn. "We give them feed grown without any chemical fertilizers," she said. "Best meat you'll ever have." Keita quickly chose the fattest goat, one with a coat of white fur except for its head, which was brown and white. They settled the price, then disagreed politely about how to properly slaughter the animal. Cheryl offered to do it herself, but Keita wanted it done in accordance with Muslim ritual. The cutting of the animal's throat with the wound facing east, the direction of the holy city of Mecca, where the Prophet Muhammad was born. This way, the blood would spill on the earth, cleansing it and honoring Muhammad's very memory, and work in the name of Islam. "Muslim hands alone must handle the animal," Keita explained. As they talked, Keita stood a few feet from Cheryl, his hands folded behind his back, in a posture of calm insistence. Cheryl smiled at him, intrigued and unsure whether or not she should be annoyed. She said, "Don't you trust me?" Then she smiled a little flirtatiously. Cheryl Banks had known Keita Traore for 7 years, since he was a graduate student in her animal anatomy class, one of the sharpest students she'd ever worked with. He was quiet and efficient, detail-oriented, and comfortable with animals. A good scientist. But she realized that morning that she really didn't know him at all. She said, a little playfully, "Keita, be honest. You won't let me touch the animal because I'm a woman. Isn't that true?" Keita politely told her a half-truth and a half-lie. "I won't let you touch the animal because you are not a Muslim," he said. This was true, but it was also true that in Keita's experience, women were not permitted to butcher meat. "I know you are skilled," he added, "but this is not a matter of trust. It is a matter of ritual. I am a Muslim, you see. A Muslim must eat only meat that is slaughtered by himself or by another Muslim." As Keita spoke, Cheryl studied him and scraped the toe of her boot in the dirt and hay, rubbing her chin and smiling. Finally, she shrugged. "Suit yourself," she said. "I don't mean to sound stupid, but I don't know. does the Quran actually have instructions for butchering meat? The fifth chapter, Keita said. We call it a surah, the term for chapter. They are not instructions exactly. They're more like guidelines. In the third paragraph, Allah warns us, and he recited the deity's wishes, roughly, for the translation from Arabic on the spot was difficult for him. You must not eat those animals which die of themselves, nor the blood of swine's flesh, and all that has been killed in any other name than that of Allah, and you must not eat the animals choked, or those animals killed by a blow, or fall, or a goring, or those killed by other animals, and you must make the animal clean by putting it to death with your own hands. Keita looked at the ground awkwardly. He said, "Religion is not like science, I suppose." American women, their directness and independence, particularly with men, made him nervous. But Cheryl's knowledge and her easy ability with animals impressed him. At the college horse stable, he'd once watched her calm a horse that had become dangerously upset, when somehow the hoof and ankle of a front leg became tangled in a strand of barbed wire carelessly left in an exercise corral. Cheryl entered the corral alone as the animal ran about frantically, at one point rearing on its hind legs to shake the wire off. She calmed the horse, talking to the animal until it stood still while she knelt on one knee and slowly removed the wire. Keita thought she must have special powers. "I didn't mean to be rude," Cheryl said suddenly. "You weren't," Keita said. "We're both scientists. We're askers of questions." She entered the pen and quickly put a rope around the goat's neck. She led Keita and the goat into the barn to a corner where a large cement slab on the ground sloped into a drain. He carefully washed his hands at a large sink using a bar of soap left by the drain. She grabbed a pair of oversized blood-stained jeans overalls from a hook and handed them to Keita. "You'd best wear these over your clothes," she said. Then she asked, "You don't mind if I watch?" "Please," Keita said, "not at all." He looked away for a moment. Then he said, "I don't want to be trouble for you, but I must do this outside, on the dirt. It is important, you see, that I spill the blood on the soil in the open air in order to cleanse the earth." She shrugged again, her hands thrust deep in her jeans pockets. "Sure," she said. "Yeah, out back of the barn, there's plenty of room." They walked across the barn, Keita carrying the overalls over his arm. Cheryl pushed open a heavy open door, and they emerged into an area of hard-packed dirt beside an empty horse corral. "This will be fine," Keita said. He pulled the overalls on over his clothes. Cheryl stood back and watched this very tall man take the animal by the head and rear, flip it on its side, press down on its head with one hand, and kneel on the torso as if he'd been doing this all his life, which he had. Normally, another man would be holding down the goat's torso and legs, but Keita would not let Cheryl touch the animal during the slaughter. Keita moved the goat so its head and throat faced east and yanked the head back to expose the throat. Then, with a freshly sharpened knife he'd brought from home in the leather bag he carried, Keita made a long, deep cut across the throat from left to right. He did it in one motion and carefully bled the animal as he leaned on its gasping and kicking body, uttering prayers in Arabic to honor both Islam and the animal for offering itself as food. "Bismillahi," he began in thanks to God. Keita, breathing a little from the effort, took twine from the leather bag and a long screwdriver he'd bought just for the slaughter. Raising one of the goat's hind legs, he used the knife to cut and separate skin from bone just above the hoof, and then inserted a screwdriver beneath the skin, carefully working it up the leg, separating skin from bone without piercing the skin. This way, he scraped out an inch-wide tubular space between the skin and bone all the way up the leg. As a boy in Africa, he'd used a long sharpened stick to do this. Keita put down the screwdriver and again, raising the hind leg, he put his mouth to the opening of the space he'd made and he began to blow and blow and blow for several minutes until the animal was bloated like a parade balloon, its skin tight with Keita's own breath. He picked up the twine and wrapped it around the leg above the hoof, cutting off the escaping air. He smiled at Cheryl and let the dead animal sit a few minutes to give the air pressure time to separate the skin from bone and muscle. "Now it will be easier to skin her," he said. Cheryl nodded. She said, "That was beautiful, the way you did that." After a while, Keita went back to work. He cut through bone and cartilage to remove the head and handed it to Cheryl, who looked back at him, surprised. He smiled. "Now," he said, "now you can touch the meat." She took the head with both hands and set it on the wax paper that she laid out on a table in the barn. Keita made a long incision from the throat along the belly, letting the animal's innards and some blood spill out on the ground. He began cutting the skin away. It was almost as easy as peeling a large orange. Then he reached inside the animal to cut and scoop out the intestines and bladder and set them all in a bucket. He cut away the thighs, handing each to Cheryl, who wrapped the meat in wax paper. Keita left the rest of the torso as it was. They wrapped it and stored it in a large freezer in the barn. Keita washed again at the sink and removed his overalls. He finished the whole job in less than an hour. Keita and Cheryl walked back to his car, each carrying packages of meat in wax paper and wrapped again in plastic bags. "Someday soon, you'll have to bring your family out to the ranch for dinner," she said. "We'll eat the rest of that goat meat, and if you want, I'll let you do all the work." Thanks very much.
Peter Chilson reading his story, American Food, from his most recent book, Disturbance-Loving Species.
Yum. Two all beef patty special, sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Mickey D's is central to 42nd and 2nd lunch breaking on the fast track. I'm packing my mini backpack with two Big Macs. There's no time today. I'm late. But in my heart, if I had my way, I'd take a rhythm and grind break. Truth be told, my ultimate goal is to feed my thoughts and soul with food I never make.
Mama Carolina, Masa Chicken Mafa, Mafa Legume, Goosey Supu, Fufu. Carolina.
I crave food, lovingly prepared by the wrinkled, supper-stained hands of my grands, with creases in places I remember them to be. Their pots blackened by the oils of 4,000 seasons of history.
Louisiana.
Installment number two. Dr. Vandana Shiva was trained as a physicist, but got involved in food democracy and sustainability issues when violence struck the state of Punjab in India in 1984. Her work led to a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. Anna Maria Roque brings us portions of Vandana Shiva's presentation from Washington State University.
When addressing the issue of food away from the Western world, we talk about the lack thereof. World hunger continues to be a growing problem, and when the U.S. is seeing higher food costs and a struggling economy, it has a negative effect worldwide. World-renowned environmental leader and provocative thinker Dr. Vandana Shiva addresses this issue in her keynote address at the Washington State University's International Education Week. She discusses sustainability and the global food crisis, how a global industrial food system is resulting in growing hunger, soaring commodity prices, and food riots. Dr. Shiva, a 2005 nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, said the World Trade Organization has effectively created hunger around the world. Dr. Shiva, a physicist by training, has spent the last 3 decades fighting against globalization and for the change in the practices and paradigms of agriculture and food. In India, Dr. Shiva established a movement for biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights. Her Seeds of Hope project has restored life to the suicide belt in India and assists communities affected by tsunamis, drought, and the effects of climate change. Her policy advocacy on the international scene has successfully defended the right to seed for farmers and the right to food and water for all. In 1993, she received the Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, and in 2001, Asia Week named her one of the top 5 most important people in Asia.
When the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches not just a cold, but a serious influenza. So when Wall Street collapses, the rest of the world's financial systems and economic system starts to unravel. The sneeze on Wall Street has spread a financial influenza everywhere. The sneeze of carbon dioxide with the excessive use of fossil fuels in this country has given us climate chaos. That's a serious influenza for the planet. But I'm glad this sneeze of democracy is going to spread worldwide. We know it's going to change things everywhere, because so much of what was happening in other parts of the world was either a direct impact or an indirect impact of what was happening in this country. So this is a virus we welcome, the democratic virus we welcome very much. It must spread and multiply. There are, of course, other viruses that haven't been so good for the world. And just a few weeks of the financial system tumbling down has robbed, I don't know, they say 25 million people in China of jobs is what the assessment is. My own country, the businesses, the big corporations were talking about a similar set of layoffs. The interesting thing is when millions, you know, are driven off the farms and driven off small-scale employment, nobody counts. It's when, you know, the big corporate world starts to lay off that the counting starts to happen. And our prime minister just had a serious meeting telling the corporations that they have a social responsibility. Suddenly, social responsibility is back in currency. It's a word you can use when you talk to businesses, because till 5 months ago, it was competition at any cost. The more greedy you were, the more rapacious you were, the better you were, because you were more competitive. And competitiveness had become the religion, and Wall Street had become the church. And the interesting thing is, the whole world was celebrating, but Wall Street was weeping. Did you see how it dropped again? They're crying that democracy won. Tells you something, that those super profits of Wall Street can only survive by killing democracy. They are afraid of democracy. They are afraid of people rising and demanding and securing their rights. So when Wall Street rejoices, people weep. When people rejoice, Wall Street weeps. And the interesting thing will be to watch over the next few months how much damage they can do to this gain by using the kind of influence they have always used. The world food crisis is one example of corporate influence that has been a very serious virus that spread worldwide, and this year it erupted in the influenza of the world food crisis. 40 countries had riots. Of course, President Bush was very quick to blame India for it and had a lovely statement. He said, India's getting rich. When people get rich, they want to eat more. They want to eat more like us, and that's why food prices are rising. Of course, every assumption in that statement was a bit off. Because you know, you can be rich, but if you're a vegetarian, you'll stay a vegetarian. You don't start eating meat just because you got rich. In fact, in the West, there are more vegetarians among the rich than otherwise. And secondly, frankly, if I became super rich, I wouldn't eat the US manufactured industrial food toxic diet. But of course, factually, it was totally false, because in the two decades of development from 1991 to now, Indians are eating less. They're eating less because our basic food security has been compromised to make globalization happen, to create the kind of growth that gets measured in the ledgers of the World Trade Organization, in the profits of Cargill. But in the lives of children and women, it translates into malnutrition and hunger. So, and the average Indian consumption of food has dropped from 178 kilograms per capita per year to 157 kilograms per capita per year. So when President Bush was talking about Indians eating more, it wasn't true. What was in fact happening was the US cereal consumption had increased by 12%. But, you know, there's a limit to how much cereal you can eat. I mean, Avery was at dinner today, was celebrating carbs. But, you know, I mean, there's a limit to how much bread, pasta you can eat, how much everything else. In reality, the increased 12% consumption of cereals was not going to feed people in this country. It was going to feed cars, drive cars. And the figures have come out now, a World Bank study that was prepared by the World Bank. And, you know, the World Bank isn't usually very good at telling us real causes. But in this case, they did say that 75% of the rise in food prices now could be explained by the diversion of food to biofuels. The remaining 25%, I explain on the basis of corporate monopolies, integration of the world food system, and all that investment that moved out of real estate and mortgages after the subprime collapse said, wow, commodities, food, that's where we put our money in to make 25% return. Because hedge funds and investment banks don't look for anything less than that. So that's your 100% accounting for the price rise. Of course, unfortunately, both the presidential candidates during the campaign did talk about biofuels as a green solution to the energy crisis and offered it as a solution to energy independence and energy security. Doesn't work out. The math doesn't work out very well. Because it takes 1.5 gallons of fossil fuel to produce a gallon of ethanol. It's a net negative energy system. You put in more fossil fuels to process the poor soya bean. In 2006, the US used 20% of its corn crop to produce 5 billion gallons of ethanol, which could only substitute 1% of the fossil fuel use. If 100% of the corn was used for biofuel, and you know what 100% use would mean, it would mean not just the US going without corn, but NAFTA forced Mexico to depend on American corn. So the Americans were having tortilla riots because the price of corn was going up for them. 100% diversion of corn to biofuel would only substitute 7% of the petrol. So you can see 93% would have to be brought from somewhere else. And that means all the land of the world would be diverted and only a few SUVs of this country could still run. So you'd have to starve the whole world to keep a few SUVs going for a few years longer. Fidel Castro called this a genocide. These are not, of course, the only issues involved. It takes 1,700 gallons of water to produce a gallon of ethanol. Ethanol also means the spread of these monocultures. And all of these shifts in the people's rights to food worldwide has meant that people are spending more. The prices worldwide have significantly increased from 2004 to 2006, and 2007 and 8, they shot up even more because of the investment aspect. Corn prices in those 3 years rose by 54%, wheat by 34%, soya oil by 71%, sugar by 75%. Of course, now with the financial unraveling, the commodity prices have come down, but the food prices have not. The poor are still spending a huge amount of food. And who's driving this? The corn merchants are the same agribusiness that shaped an industrial agriculture. They're Cargill, ADM, Conagra. For seeds, it's Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta. For palm oil, which is deforesting the Indonesian rainforests, and from the United Nations assessments, by 2030, all of the rainforests of Borneo could be gone with the expansion of palm oil. One would imagine the Indonesians control palm oil. Cargill controls that too. Soya trade, it's Bunge, ADM, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus. Seeds, again, Monsanto, DuPont. So if you really want to understand the roots of the world food crisis, I think one needs to kind of go back to many of the sneezes that took place in this country over time. Some spread beyond the borders, others stayed here. The Green Revolution was the first attempt at expanding the control of US agribusiness over agriculture in other countries. The interesting name really did not come out because green was popular in those days. It wasn't even in the vocabulary in 65. You know, green is a very recent word in defining the environmental movement. After the Green Party rose to power in Germany, the word green was merely just another color different from red. And red was the terror in China. Because China had gone red, India had to be prevented from growing red. And the analysis was fascinating because they said, if we do not make peasants rich, peasants are going to have a revolution. And they'll go the communist way. So we've got to make them rich, and we've got to bring them into a very commercial agriculture. The assumption was, if you make agriculture capital intensive, peasants get rich. again, the sums don't work out. If I spend more, do I get poorer or do I get richer? A capital-intensive agriculture means more poverty, more indebtedness, more loss of land, more creation of landlessness. So they kind of forgot about the debt part, just as recently they forgot that you can't, if, you know, you put all of society on a credit spending, sooner or later you'll get into trouble. That's what the whole Wall Street collapse was about, living on credit. The Green Revolution was about credit, and they forgot that sooner or later this is not going to work. But 1965, a drought was used to impose this industrial agriculture on India. Nobody accepted it, except one man who had friends in the World Bank. And they worked it out. So don't worry, forget democracy, forget the parliament, forget even the prime minister of that time, Lal Bahadur Shastri.
We'll be back with Vandana Shiva after a short break.
Advice: lego the meat and eat more vegetable. Keep your diet more conscious, people. Yeah. Remember mad cow disease
and the bird flu.
All right. Hear it. Vegetable. No meaty, 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 meaty. Could I never ever sweetie, 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 sweetie. I like her when me cook up in me veggie, 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 veggie.
This is Yin Radio, and for Thanksgiving, we're exploring food and food issues around the world. We've been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva from her presentation about sustainability, the global food crisis, and food democracy at Washington State University earlier this month. When we left her talk, Vandana Shiva was talking about industrialized agriculture coming to India.
Now, I got interested in this issue because in 1984, we had the worst violence in the state of Punjab. The state of Punjab was the richest state in India. But people were turning to extremism and terrorism. 30,000 people were killed. And the result of it was, you know, the army and police had to take over the state. I have often said Punjab was six times 9/11, but the world did not notice. I'm a physicist, and to me, there were just two questions in my mind that I had to answer. The first was, if the Nobel Prize was given to Norman Borlaug for creating the Green Revolution, how come Punjab was not a land of peace but became a land of war? What went wrong? And the second was, if Punjab was really that wealthy, why were the people so angry? And by the end of it, I kind of figured out what this thing called the Green Revolution was and wrote a book for the United Nations called The Violence of the Green Revolution, and understood then that the roots of hunger were built into it. The first level of hunger was created because actually the Green Revolution, contrary to the popular explanation, was not producing more food. Now, everyone says this is what got India out of famine. This is the secret to India moving from what they call a ship-to-mouth existence. None of it was true. We hadn't had a famine in 65. We'd had a drought, very different. Famine, people die of lack of food. Drought, the rain drops a little bit. And in this region, I'm told you're in the rain shadow, a drought is something that farmers deal with. By the time I'd finished my study, I'd realized per acre we were producing less food. Per acre we were producing less food, but we were producing more commodities. We were producing more rice and wheat that the farmers sold. But we were producing no lentils, no dals, no pulses, no legumes, no oilseeds, none of the mixed agriculture that is required for a full food security in our kind of context of primarily vegetarian diet. if you look at the nutritional per acre or food per acre output, it had dropped dramatically. But the second level at which hunger was being created by the system was when farmers have to take credit to buy the chemicals, they have to sell what they grow to pay that credit back. So ultimately, chemical industrial farmers under conditions of poverty never eat what they grow. They're selling everything. And that's what explains this crazy situation of today, that most of the hungry people of the world are actually rural agricultural producers. This is new. Hunger used to be an urban affair when in 1942, with the Great Bengal Famine, 2 million people died in Bengal because the British took every bit of rice and exported it. It wasn't that we didn't have enough rice in the country, but all of it was exported for the war. All those 2 million, most of the 2 million were in the cities. They weren't in the villages. But today, the 1 billion who go hungry in the world are primarily in rural areas. Primarily in rural areas. And that's because these agricultural systems, on the one hand, constantly take away from the producer what the producer has grown, or after some amount of indebtedness, take away from the producer the very land on which you could have a livelihood or produce your food. With the second big sneeze from the United States that gave the world a huge food insecurity influenza was the World Trade Organization. And we've had trade before. You know, India exported spices centuries and centuries ago. Even poor Columbus was actually seeking India spices. He lost his way and came to this country. And therefore, the Native Americans have always been called Indians because of his error of where he landed. But it was looking for spices. And Columbus was entering the spice trade because we had the trade anyway. If you look at the trade driven by the World Trade Organization today, it is not trade in an excess. It is trade that is creating a deficit. That's why I have called it not free trade, it is forced trade. You're forced to engage in it against your sovereign decisions. But who made the decisions? Who made the decisions of WTO? You know, before WTO, there was created at the same time when, you know, they're going to meet on 15th of November for what they call Bretton Woods II. The Bretton Woods institutions, World Bank, IMF, were created as part of that, and a third little twin called the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which should have become a trade institution, but didn't, partly because the first meeting was in Havana, and, you know, the U.S. has always had problem with anything in Havana. So the Havana Charter and the Havana model was never adopted till 1995, we get the World Trade Organization. Now, I was very fortunate that I happened in 87 to be invited to a meeting in Geneva. I had no idea all this was going on. But the corporations were all there. And they talked about how they would have a new world order on food. And they laid out their dream. And their dream was only genetically engineered seed, all seeds patented, and total global integration of the food system. I've spent my life defending biodiversity, the integrity of life, the intrinsic value of every species, every person, every race, every gender. And the idea of ownership over life was just, you know, for me, you know, a red blanket in front of the bull. But also the idea that life would be patented meant now it was being assumed that life is a creation of corporations. But it's not. It's scientifically not true. Life makes itself. That's what's so beautiful about life. You put a little seed into the soil and it makes itself, you know. Doesn't need permission from Monsanto. Can I grow now? Can I turn left for the sunshine? Can I turn right? It just grows. It grows with the elements. It grows with the soil, with the sunshine. So the idea that seeds would now be treated as the invention of corporations. Untruth, and that's the second thing that really stirs me. I can't deal with untruth. I just can't deal with it. Yeah. You want to get me really engaged, tell a lie. And it seemed half my life, you know, I'm spending so much time just saying, no, it's not true that the Green Revolution produced more food. And it's not true that a seed is an invention. A seed is the embodiment of millennia of years of evolution of that species and centuries of the interaction between human intelligence, the farmers, their breeding. Industrial breeding is very recent, and it can just sort of tinker a little bit. Even when they shift genes around and create genetically engineered organisms, which is when the pattern started, it's a bit like, you know, bringing this chair into this hall. You bring a gene from one organism to another, you bring a gene, a chair from one building to another. Does this movement of the chair turn into the construction of this building? Doesn't, isn't it? Just a movement of a chair. It's a shuffling of furniture. Genetic engineering is a shuffling of genes. You know, we should be putting U-Haul every time they do genetic engineering. But how can you then say you've created the whole thing, and not just the whole thing, but generations and generations of its capacity to multiply, reproduce, be its own thing? Monsanto, along with a group of companies, realized there's big money in this. There's big money if you can own and control life, because landlords only take rents on land and buildings. Life lords take rents out of every generation of reproduction of a species. So Monsanto, with others, got together and wrote a treaty called the Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. My government, led by an amazing man who I work very closely with, S.P. Shukla, said, but you know, this is nothing to do with trade. How we give patents, how we assign copyright is something about domestic decision making. This is not about trade. So the U.S. lawyers in Washington just went back and put TR before IP, and that's why it's called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. What a mouthful. Interesting other combination is the same companies that control the seed and biotechnology commercially today are companies that control agrochemicals, and they're companies that control medicine and pharmaceuticals. So they're talking about very large-scale control over life. If just sitting back, buying up companies, a Monsanto can take over the entire seed supply of a country like India, there's no limit to their wealth. Profits increased 100% last year. On top of it, they increased the price of corn seed. I think it went up from $200 a bag to $300 a bag in the middle of the crisis. But what does it cost to a small farmer in India? In the last decade, we have had 200,000 farmer suicides. 200,000. Why are the farmers of India committing suicide? When the seed costs go up, nearly 100 times is where it went, you can imagine how it changes the peasant economy. So farmers get into debt. And meantime, the Cargills of the world, using all the subsidies from your tax money, overall in the rich countries, the agricultural subsidy is $400 billion. That's more than $1 billion a day. That's what's causing hunger and the food crisis worldwide. One sneeze in Wall Street can sniff out the life of millions and millions of farmers, but also millions of poor people whose entire economic entitlement changes.
Bandana Shiva's presentation was recorded at Washington State University by Nancy Casey and edited by Anna Maria Roque. And Anna Maria brings us the last installment for our international food theme, reminding us that Thanksgiving is a uniquely American holiday with universal undertones.
I'm Anna Maria Roque, and this is Thanksgiving from a foreigner's perspective. As of October 25th, I have lived in the United States for 6 years. 6 years means that I've got to enjoy the American Thanksgiving 6 times. Frankly, I can't remember my first Thanksgiving. Maybe because I was still adjusting from culture shock, or maybe we didn't celebrate it at all. You see, in Holland and Germany, we don't celebrate Thanksgiving. People always seem a bit surprised when they ask me, but then I am quickly to remind them that the first Thanksgiving, the story of the settlers sharing a meal with the Native Americans, took place in North America, and therefore became a North American holiday. It was in college that I really started to appreciate Thanksgiving, and dread it at the same time. You see, Thanksgiving break comes after 13 weeks of school, and right before the crunch time of finals. It is a much-needed time for students to take a deep breath, catch up on sleep as well as schoolwork, and to prepare for the weeks ahead. At the same time, you are reminded that Christmas is right around the corner, and in between studying for finals and writing essays, you ought to be thinking about what you're buying for whom, and how you're going to pay for it. Ironically, I have always been one of those students who manages to catch a cold during the first days of my vacation, and then spending the days leading up to Thanksgiving hoping to get my taste back. However, the reason I appreciate Thanksgiving so much is the whole idea behind it. Forget about the food, forget about football, but look at the people you surround yourself with that day. Whether it's your parents, your siblings, your friends, your co-workers, or your significant others, having those people in your life is something to be thankful for. In the years that I have celebrated Thanksgiving, I've always spent it with a rather international group of people, whether Danish, Spanish, German, or Dutch, who traditionally don't celebrate this holiday. We usually get together with a rather large group, divide the dishes among the various families. Last year, my family was assigned to bring dessert. And so, the morning of Thanksgiving, my mother and I stood, leaning over the kitchen counter, looking at recipes for traditional American pies, such as pumpkin, cherry, and pecan pies. And since we were Dutch, we were to make Dutch apple pie. Fun fact, by the way, in Holland, we just call that apple pie. So here we are, following the recipes that for many Americans have a certain sentimental value. It brings back childhood memories of grandmother's baking and such. Thus, in honor of the minority of Americans we celebrate Thanksgiving with, we really wanted to do our best to give them something traditional. My mother, being a genius in the kitchen, had absolutely no problem with the cherry, pecan, and apple pies. The pumpkin pie making, however, was just a giant fiasco of my mother questioning my instructions as I poured various ingredients into the liquid, gooey mix. Are you sure it's that much sugar? This doesn't look right. Is it supposed to be this liquid? Did we forget something? Question after question. After we made the dough and mixed the ingredients together for the filling and much nervous laughter, we read and reread and read once again the recipe and finally gave up on the few tiny clumps left in the liquidy filling and put the pies in the oven. Meanwhile, debating our other options of maybe getting a Marie Callender's pie and seeing if there would still be a bakery open somewhere. Playing a board game as the filling rose in the heat of the oven, we checked on the pie about every 2 minutes. It was like watching the football game, in which we were rooting for Team Dutch, and every update on the filling getting sturdier was like scoring a touchdown. In the end, the pies looked just fine and people loved them. In fact, they loved them so much that this year, to our horror, we are assigned to making them again. Now you see, what I remember from that day is not the food, not how good the pie was, but rather the fun I had with my mother in the kitchen, and the company I enjoyed over dinner. And that is what makes this holiday something to be thankful for, and why I like Thanksgiving.
We'll end this Yin Radio program with a piece from Ruth Theodore's debut album. Described as 13 tracks of beautifully twisted, political, and personal mayhem. The album is called Worm Food, and the song, Home.
Be a mansion on a mountaintop. mobile home with a couple of bottles, your skin and bones, your skin and bones are about to be somebody's
you could join me for this episode of Yin Radio about international food. You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Y-I-N Radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. You can catch past shows and sign up for podcasts at www.yinradio.org. To those of you listening on the Detour in Appalachia or via Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, or Thin Air Radio in Spokane. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the Avon Hello Tomorrow Fund, which has awarded $5,000 each week since April 2007 to an individual who has helped realize a program, a project, or idea that empowers women and ultimately improves society. For Yin Radio, the fund selected me as its winner for the week of November 18 through 24. One of only 13 weekly winners to be selected from more than 750 applicants from across the U.S. who applied to the current quarterly application cycle. Thanks to the Avon Hello Tomorrow Fund for recognizing the value of Yin Radio to women and society. Learn more about the Avon Hello Tomorrow Fund at www.avon.com/hellotomorrowfund. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation and me. I'm Sandy Billings. Until next week.
Could have been a mansion on a mountaintop. Mobile home.